You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly roundup of the news, Just Ask the Press. And as usual, with us is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin. And now John's got his ring back. He's got the championship ring. He never gave it up. Back now as editor at large from CQ Roll Call, but also now the White House correspondent once again from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. John, congratulations on keeping the championship ring and getting it back.
Oh, thank you very much. It's it's the most interesting and I think important beat, and I'm honored that. That Jason Dick, our editor-in-chief, asked me to do this again. I want to give a verbal nod and a hat tip to Nils Lesniewski, who has been the White House correspondent for the last 4 years. He did a really nice job, especially with pooling, and he did a lot of internal stuff for us. He's stepping into a new role in a few weeks, and I just want to say thanks to him.
And yes, it is an important role. We do need some people with some experience there. That's my beef on the role today. We're gonna unpack quite a bit, and so it's good to have you back there, brother.
Good to be back.
We're gonna unpack quite a bit today. Trump's legal squabbles. What does the Fani Willis Georgia ruling mean to Donald Trump? The Mar-a-Lago rule, is it beneficial? The ruling in Mar-a-Lago, is it beneficial to the prosecution or the defense? And of course, the Manhattan case has been put off for 30 days, and we'll talk about all of that. We're also going to ask you a few questions about, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? That's Donald Trump's main emphasis, it seems, these days. The TikTok ban, is that good or bad for the U.S.? The latest feelings from the U.S. Congress and from people inside the White House about Netanyahu, does he got to go? And finally, Bernie wants us to have a 32-hour work week. Are we ready to increase our productivity to 32 out of 16? That's Michael's question, and we'll answer that one. Stick around for that and a lot more when we come back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question, and I am your host, Brian Karam, with our weekly wrap-up in the news, Just Ask the Press. With me, as always, former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, but now also the White House correspondent for CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. Gentlemen, thanks. Let's start off with the Georgia ruling. In a nutshell, Georgia judge dropped six counts in the case. Judge McAfee threw out six criminal counts from the indictment against Trump and his allies. Trump now faces 10 felony charges in Georgia instead of 13. But the big news there, a judge in Fulton County ruled that District Attorney Fani Willis can remain on the election interference case against Trump as long as special prosecutor Nathan Wade stepped aside, which he did hours later. So, Michael, I'll let you unwrap all of that. Does it matter if the special prosecutor would it have been better if Fani Willis had dropped out? Because after all, Nathan Wade was, you know, the hands-on prosecutor. What do we got there, brother?
Well, so the allegations against Fani Willis and Nathan Wade were that they engaged in a relationship that allowed for there to be financial gain inappropriately, and that implicitly there was therefore a benefit to them that resulted in an actual conflict of interest. The judge said that there was an appearance of conflict of interest, and that in order to cure that, one of two things has to happen. Either Fani Willis and her whole office has got to go, or Nathan Wade has got to go. And as we talked about previously, the most damaging thing that could have happened in this case would have been the judge to excuse the entire district attorney's office of Fulton County, which would mean that the case would be assigned to the commission, which would then look for another U.S. attorney, another district attorney's office to prosecute the case, which means this case would never have gone forward in any reasonable amount of time. So the judge did Fannie Willis a big favor. He criticized her roundly, said that her testimony was in some sense unbelievable and inappropriate. And they said that, however, there is no basis under Georgia law to recuse them both because of bad decision making. So in the end, Fannie Willis dodges a bullet. Nathan Wade is gone. He should have retired. He should have resigned before this whole thing started. What Fannie Willis should do, in my estimation, is now be invisible, that someone else should be the face of this case in the media, and she should sort of go back into the shadows and work on other matters within the case, because every time you see her, it resurrects this issue. And I think it was notable that I don't think after this hearing and decision by the court, Fannie Willis held a press conference. I don't think the post decision, I think post decision, there was no press conference. So that's a good sign that maybe they're learning this. But the bottom line of all of this is they dodged a bullet. Wade is out. He's irrelevant. There are many other prosecutors who they say actually are even stronger than Wade. There was some surprise that Wade was chosen because they said there were a lot of other stronger prosecutors available. And Willis is allowed to stay on, her office is allowed to stay on the case, which is all that matters. So they lucked out.
What about the three? What about the six criminal counts from the indictment being thrown out? Is that the quash counts all focus on alleged efforts by the defendants to solicit public officials, including the Georgia Secretary of State, members of the Georgia House and Senate, to violate their oaths of office? That's been thrown out. Does this matter? Does it mean anything?
Well, if you're a defendant and you get a charge against you thrown out, that's a good day. But there are enough counts left over that it's not going to impact the overall outcome. And what this was a very technical decision. The way the law works is you have a right to know with specificity what you're being charged with so you can defend it.
Defend,
I can't,
right.
for example, indict somebody and say, I hereby indict you because you violated the law. Come to court. The answer would be, what law? You need to specify it. So when I come to court, if I have a dog bite, I can bring my dog. If I have a cat in the tree, I can bring my cat. And so what the judge said is that this, you caused them to violate their oath of office, was not clear enough. And so what I'm going to tell you is I'm dismissing these counts, but you can bring them back again. Just go back to the grand jury and specify more clearly what it is that you're charging them with. And they can decide to do that or not. But as I say, if they choose not to do it, there's still enough case, there are enough counts left in the case that in the end, were there a conviction, the fact that there aren't these six counts is pretty meaningless. The count that matters is the RICO count, the overarching count one. Racketeering influence, corrupt organization count. And these allegations that are within these counts that were dismissed are part of that RICO count too. So that evidence about the 10,000, about the 11,780 vote call between Trump and Raffensperger, that evidence is still coming in through the RICO charge. So it's a win in a technical sense, but it
For
has
Trump.
no For Trump, and it has no overarching meaning.
But the question remains, and John, man, I got to hear you on this one because we've covered the White House together. You're there again. This may not, Michael might be right that, as far as the court part of it goes, but it looks to me like the politics for Trump are beating the legal ramifications that Donald Trump has to face. Yes?
The political strategy for Trump right now is driving the train here, and it is defeating all the legal strategies from the most of the prosecution teams so far. Now, we don't know about the classified documents case, but the others that we know a lot more about, man, this is, I said a few weeks ago here that, you know, a couple layers of the onion had been peeled away, and this is starting, I don't want to say it's falling apart, because he still faces plenty of criminal charges.
88 of them.
But that onion that was, you know, you go to your local supermarket and you see the big red onion, right? Well, this isn't a big red onion. This is getting to be a smaller onion. It's not falling apart, but the trick here from the Trump team is clear. It's still Steve Bannon. It's still flood the zone with shit. And in this instance, flooding the zone, motions, documents, this and that, Fannie Willis's bad judgment, somehow Mr. Bragg, the Manhattan DA, can't get 100,000 pages of documents from the U.S. Attorney's Office for its investigation into the same hush money scheme. What is going on here? What's going on here is the Trump team is being able to delay things. And they don't have to get all this thrown out. They don't even have to beat the charges. They have to get it close to or after the election. And then they have to get it after he stands on the stage in Milwaukee and accepts the nomination. And there could be pressure then to drop some of these charges. But the trick here is for him to get elected again. And I'm telling you, folks, if he gets elected again, watch it all go away. Like it never happened. All of it.
John makes mention, Michael, of the Manhattan case. It was put off for 30 days and the Bragg stuff. What happened there? Let's.
You know, the legal expression is called beats the shit out of me.
What did you study that under Ritz and Torts?
Yeah, what year of law school is that?
That's a first year concept.
First year, okay.
What's going on here is that the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan investigated the allegations of Michael Cohen and the hush money and all that stuff for a long time, and they declined to prosecute that case. Alvin Bragg's office, I think then under Cy Vance, his predecessor, right, decided to look into it too, and they decided to indict. So Bragg says to the U.S. attorney, give us all your documents in your investigation, because we're going to need it, you know, for ourselves, and we're going to have an obligation to turn it over to the defense because it's relevant evidence that discovery allows them to receive. They received some documents from the U.S. attorney's office, Bragg's office did, and the U.S. attorney's office said, all right, that's pretty much it. And Bragg said, you sure? They said, yeah, that's pretty much it. Then Trump subpoenas the U.S. attorney's office a year late. I mean, it's unbelievable, but a year late, they subpoena the U.S. attorney's office and they say, got anything in this area? They said, oh, yeah, but we got about 100,000 pages that we never gave to Bragg. And Bragg, using another, this is a second year law school term, says, what the fuck? 100,000 documents that you didn't give to us? And so the judge taking, that's right. So the judge taking those two legal concepts together has decided that this case is going to be put off for a month so he can get to the bottom of what's going on here and also give the defense an opportunity to review these documents. So, you know, it's a what the fuck shit show.
That's a third year term.
But a shit show is exactly what Donald Trump wants. This is playing into his hands. This is all turned in a big way in his favor. It's unbelievable covering and watching this guy over and over again throughout his entire political career and his adult life. And the pattern is playing out again.
It, I to me, yes, and to me, honestly, it what's frightening to me is just watching how no offense to reporters, lawyer, well, offense to reporters and lawyers everywhere, but what the fuck is a great question to ask if you're a prosecutor? I don't know. You tell me, you know better than I, Michael, but it seems to me like, the four estates are crumbling quickly, and including,
Well,
the prosecution, I have no faith in it anymore.
the bottom line, there are a couple of bottom lines. One is if and when, and if may be more than when at the moment, but if and when trials begin, all of this stuff falls by the wayside. Once you have defendant Trump in a courtroom under obligation to be there as a criminal defendant, then all of the stuff that John is rightly talking about, which is in his political favor, I think recedes. And people who are open-minded will focus on the evidence and
Will it ever
determine what.
get there, though?
Well, that's why I say if and when, if
Right.
it does. And I think it will. And I think it will. And then we'll see. We talked about this previously in polling. There's data built in deeply to the data that says, were Trump convicted, that might change their point of view as to whether they would support him. And so we'll see if that's true. But right now, the DA in Georgia dodges a bullet, and we'll see when that case can go forward. And Bragg has a reprieve of 30 days to get his house in order. It's really not Bragg's house that's in order. It's the U.S. Attorney's Office that screwed everything up. And I think that both of these cases can still go forward. I think there's plenty of time for them to go forward. And we'll just have to see what the judges' calendars look like.
I would think that they would prioritize this case, but what do I know? The
It is. I'm sorry. I just think it's very significant that we're now talking about this in terms of if and when, not when. For over a year, we've said when all this goes to trial. Now we're talking about if. And I just think it's incredible what the way this has turned in the last, 2 weeks.
Yeah. That when let's talk a little bit about before we go to break, the Mar-a-Lago ruling. Is it?
Wait, can I just say one thing on the political side of it? Brian Kemp, the Republican governor of Georgia, signed a law this week. I forget which day. He signed a law this week that allows for a commission that's been set up to sanction and remove prosecutors. Their notion is that it'll help remove rogue prosecutors. So we'll see now whether or not the governor, through this commission, is going to somehow try to remove Fannie Willis and her office from being able to prosecute this case. So there's a parallel line of interference that Kemp now may be running, which would, if successful, derail this prosecution as well. So anyway, back to your question. Mar-a-Lago.
Yes.
There was a hearing in Mar-a-Lago before Judge Aileen Cannon. Two of Trump's seven motions were heard. People were a little bit surprised that she heard testimony on these motions because they seemed the type of motions that should be decided on the paper without need for oral argument. But maybe to give her credit, bending over backwards, she decided to do this, or to slam her. She's too inexperienced for this case. In any event, she had a hearing with these two motions, one of which was to dismiss the indictment because the Espionage Act, an act which has been around for a very long time, has been used repeatedly, Trump said was too vague as applied to him and therefore unconstitutional, and the case should be dismissed. And Eileen Cannon rejected that motion. And so that was, you know, done away with. Then the second motion was a little bit more complicated motion, and what she decided there was that while Trump would lose this motion to dismiss the indictment, she would allow him to sort of re-bring it later on in the case.
Right.
And, you know, so people have talked about this as sort of a bad day for Trump. He loses two motions to dismiss, but really he lost one, and the other one has sort of been deferred. And now we're on to the next series of motions. And the question that sort of overrides everything in here is Eileen Cannon trying to slow walk this case to death with political purpose, or is she so inexperienced that she is, you know, taking her time on things that really shouldn't take much time, and she should get to the heart of the matter? We just don't know.
Either way, what matter does it make what the motive is? We see what the results are. It is being slow walked to death. And probably the case that everyone, legal scholars say, is probably the best open and shut case against Donald Trump, right? I mean, that it's so whatever her motives are matters not to me. The results are that it is being slow walked. I want to go back to one thing that there was another argument that Donald Trump made this week that about not being able to, part of his argument against the Manhattan, I think it was the Manhattan case, was that, you know, there would be questions of unlimited immunity brought up in that case, which was confusing to me because everything that he's accused of in Manhattan, you know, we've spoken before about how it's mostly a misdemeanor. They're trying to stretch it into a felony. But since it all happened before he was president, claiming any type of presidential immunity there, to me, would he go back to fifth grade and say, you know, when I jacked you for, you know, your lunch money, I'm free to go because of unlimited presidential immunity? How did that? That's the last question I have, is how does that logically make any sense?
The thought is that while the behavior started prior to his presidential term, or it took place after his presidential term, there was a bit of overlap during his presidential term. And any act that is within the presidential term, they say, brings the whole, you know, ball of wax into the question of, does he have presidential immunity? So you look, the thing that you hear over and over is Trump's strategy is delay, delay, delay. And they say that pejoratively. But of course, anyone who has ever been a defense attorney, and I was one before I was a
prosecutor, yeah,
knows that that's what they should be doing.
Yeah, exactly.
They're lawyers for all of the, you know, cynicism about them and all the, you know, the hits they take on TV. They're doing their job, which is keeping this case from going to trial.
Yes.
I told this story once that
But Michael, wait a minute. Isn't it honestly, and let's just be honest about it. Sure, that's what your defense attorney should do. That's what you want him to do. But isn't this an example? He likes to talk about two-tier justice system. Isn't it an example of the fact that if you have money, you're better able to fight these squabbles than if you don't? Because if it were anyone else, all three of us included, we would not have the resources to put up the fight that Donald Trump has.
Well, Bennett does, but you and I.
That's right. He's going back to the White House. We know
what his bankroll is going to look like. Yeah. But, you know, Trump is correct that there is a two-tier system of justice. What he's incorrect is that he's on the bottom tier of it. He's on the top tier of it. And on top of the insult to injury of it, is he's on top of the food chain pyramid, And he's not even paying for his legal expenses. His donors are paying for it. So it's so ironic that here's a guy who's claiming, "Poor me, I'm on the bottom of a two-tiered system of justice," when in fact he's on the top of the justice system and he's not paying his bills. Okay.
I had to go look, Michael, as you were saying that, and I opened my work email inbox, and at the top is an email from the Trump campaign asking for donation. Yeah, and it's not the first one that landed today. So you're absolutely correct.
I hope you're going to donate so you can stay on the mailing list for the sake of journalism.
Well, I've been asked to be removed from that mailing list, and every time I do, I get back on it somehow. I think it's just pure torture at this point.
Yeah, I don't think many people come off that list.
No, I don't think there's little chance.
Well,
Well,
it's like the old story of the badge of honor was being on Nixon's enemies list. So maybe there's that you guys are so damn important. I can't get on the list. I say I'd like emails. They say, "Forget it, Zeldin. You're not worthy." So,
now these campaigns text you. I mean, I do miss getting my texts from Nikki Haley that begin, "Hi, John, it's Nikki."
yeah,
You
that's
know, we were pals there for a while, and then just gone. Another friendship gone.
That's not enough money. We're not friends
Just
anymore.
Yeah,
put it on the
John,
stack.
that old song of breaking up is hard to do is,
No, she was just, I mean, I got an email, I got a text from the Haley campaign literally the morning of her announcement. They had not announced that she was going to speak. And
Yes.
I got it. I guess it was probably scheduled, but
About
anyway,
15 minutes
I got
before she
your.
spoke or something is when I got mine. It was like, "Oh, I guess she's going up to speak." That's but anyway, yeah, but we're going to consider all of this and a lot more, but we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to ask the question, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karen, with a week in review. Just Ask the Press. As we left, we were all talking about strange notes we got from Nikki Haley making our wives question who the hell Nikki was. But that's a topic for another time, John. The question of the week remains, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Donald Trump has taken that tactic, pulled straight out of the old Ronald Reagan playbook, to ask American voters if they are better off now than they were 4 years ago. And for those who don't remember, 4 years ago, Donald Trump ha appeared in the briefing room of the White House and talked about how they couldn't get the uninsured tested for COVID. He had told us that my favorite exchange, gentlemen, ladies, can we get the uninsured tested? I asked. And they kept walking and talking. Katie Miller, the vice president's press secretary, turned and said, screaming for the camera isn't going to get you anywhere. And Steve Portnoy from CBS said, well, we'd like an answer to the question. It's never been answered, was never answered then. If you were poor, you couldn't even get tested for COVID at the time. We did not have enough COVID tests, although we could have adopted the World Health Organization's test, but we would have had to pay for them, and we didn't do it. We were woefully unprepared for the COVID epidemic. At that point in time, Larry Kudlow was saying that we're and Steve Mnuchin were saying we could expect 20% unemployment because of COVID, which Donald Trump kept telling us in the briefing room exactly 4 years ago today that it was going to soon end, and that's why We didn't really care. And when asked if he took any responsibility for it, he said, no, I take no responsibility. That was 4 years ago. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Start with you, John, are you?
Yeah, I definitely am for a lot of different reasons. But we, you know, we have polling to go off of. We have focus groups and just a general sentiment. Even though a lot of people are better off than they were 4 years ago, they don't necessarily feel like it. Their perception is that they're not. And, you know, a lot of the reason for that is inflation. Gas prices are still higher now. You know, the price of things went up. Now, the inflation rate has cooled, kind of plateaued, but prices haven't exactly gone back down if you've been to the supermarket lately or
no
anywhere
kidding.
Really. Travel's more a lot more expensive. So while people, you know, are probably doing at least as well as they were then, they don't necessarily feel like they're better off. And that's all that matters. It doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter if you sit down with someone and throw open their books and show them that they're better off. And we're all not getting COVID. I did chuckle, Brian, you'll get this. The White House briefing room is not a big space. It might look large on television, but it's not. And I sat down Tuesday for a briefing and thought, oh, let's all give each other COVID here, like 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So people don't feel better off. And that's all that matters. And that's that. And that falls on Biden. That's on his shoulders to you know, he's the incumbent president. The buck stops here. Donald Trump just has to plant enough doubt in people's minds that they're not better off. Joe Biden has to prove to people and convince them they're better off. That's a harder sell. And he's not been anything close to successful at convincing people they are. The message, you know, he gives a version of the same speech over and over and over, and it's just not working. And I'm curious if they'll try to get him in some different environments, town halls, maybe some sit down one-on-one interviews, that kind of thing, because just that canned Bidenomics speech, it's just not working. So I'm better off than I was 4 years ago. A lot of people are. But that's just not where the country is right now. That sense is the opposite. People think they're not better off, and that's a problem for Biden.
Yeah, a matter of perception, and you're right. It does fall strictly on Biden. Michael, here was one of my other favorite moments exactly 4 years ago. Kellyanne Conway and Larry Kudlow showed up in the briefing room and told us that the threat of COVID-19 was contained or virtually contained. And Conway, she lashed out at Paula Reid, who was at CBS at the time, when Reid mentioned the virus was spreading. And Conway said, are you a doctor? And then a few seconds later, then she admitted that the virus was spreading. And then she went after me because I asked her about testing. And so I said, don't get snarky. Just answer the questions. And she wouldn't do it. And
those briefings. Oh, my God. Those briefings.
What bothered that administration was the obvious question. So here's the obvious question. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago, Michael?
Well, yeah, 4 years ago, I had to have some minor surgery. It turned out to be fine, completely benign. So, yeah, then I was much better off now than I am then because of that surgery.
That's good.
The rest of the stuff, it's a push, you know?
Yeah,
I don't know. You know, and John is absolutely right. Objectively speaking, my 401k, my IRA, those are all better off today. What limited portfolio of stocks I own, mutual funds, actually, better off today than I was then. To the extent that I care about working people in America, I'm glad that there's an infrastructure bill that.
Yes.
Is going to put people to work, and that there's a clean energy bill that is going to put people to work and make the environment safer for my children and their children. So, yeah, by objective standards, we are much better off than we were then. However, perception becomes reality, and people don't feel that optimism that is so important in determining whether you feel better today or you felt better before. And of course, in America, I think there's a collective amnesia, which is that they don't remember 4 years ago or 3 years
God,
ago or 2
yes.
years ago,
10 minutes ago.
what, sort of what the world was like then. And so Biden, as we've talked about this before, has a burden of convincing people. I've talked about ad nauseum, the 1948 Harry Truman campaign, where Truman was in a very similar position in running against Dewey and eked it out by being ever present in people's backyards on his train whistle stops and the like. And I think there's a template there for Biden to follow, and hopefully they'll release him to do that. Because whatever you think about Biden, he's a very capable retail politician. When you're with him, you feel good, essentially, because he's a very people-oriented, empathetic human being. And if he can get out there and talk to people in that way, I think he can help himself enormously. Why he's being protected against himself is beyond me, because he is going to make gaffes. There's no question about that. He's going to be inarticulate sometimes, but those things are overcome, I think, when people say, you know what, but I like him. He's a
Right.
likable. Take George W. Bush. George W. Bush
Yes, please.
won in some measure on the likability factor, that he was the guy who, given a choice between going to a bar and sitting down with Al Gore or George Bush, you pick Bush. Even though Gore, who I've sat down with and is a nice guy, the perception was Bush was the more enjoyable companion.
Oh yeah, he was a party boy.
And Biden is a good guy to hang around with, and he's a nice guy. And if people get that opportunity to see him front and center over and over and over, the theory that I have is that they'll like him. And if they like him, they'll vote for him. If they don't know who he is still, and they don't, because the vote in 2020 was really an anti-Trump vote more than a pro-Biden vote, they have to find out a way to get people to be pro-Biden, because anti-Trump this time around may not be enough for them.
Yeah, and both of you point to something that I've said numerous times. Look, it's always appearance versus reality. The appearance is that Donald Trump is on your side. The appearance was Donald Trump was taking care of 4 years ago. The appearance that Donald Trump was taking care of the COVID virus, when in fact he had dismantled the very group of people that could help. He had dismantled a lot of the federal response to epidemics. And then let's take a look at his task force at that time. They're preaching a need for social distancing, saying, we needed to stand 6 feet apart and wear, masks. Yet, and John, you may have been there with me on this on a couple of those occasions. Trump would walk into that briefing room without a mask on and standing, crowding 10 people so close together on stage they could literally breathe each other's fumes. And they're telling us to stay 6 feet apart. So America always seems to fall for the appearance versus the reality. And the reality is you are better off than you were 10, 4 years ago. The perception is, according to Donald Trump, that you're not. So with appearances being good or bad, the topic of conversation, moving on to the TikTok ban. There is a young man who was on the show a few weeks ago, Ryan Macbeth, who does a lot of debunking of all kinds of conspiracy theories and stuff on, Ukraine and taking a look at social interaction on the internet, who says that TikTok was a cyber weapon and it was a good idea to for what the House and has done in a bipartisan manner in voting to get rid of TikTok. And I'd like to take that on. And John, let you start there. Where do you think the TikTok ban is? I mean, a lot of people make money off it, man. There are a lot of young people that are pissed off that you're going to ban TikTok because they make money. It's not really a total ban, nor could it be. But there are free speech questions, and there are questions as to whether or not this was the right move. What do you think?
I think it faces an uphill battle in the Senate for various reasons, and the free speech part of this is a big reason why I think it faces an uphill battle in that chamber. The Senate moves slower usually than the House. The chairwoman of the committee, the Commerce Committee, Maria Cantwell, a Democrat from Washington State, she has concerns. She has introduced another version of the bill. I don't want to say watered down because that's a pejorative, and I haven't reviewed every page of the legislation, but it doesn't go as far as the House bill. And the White House has not said if the president would sign the Cantwell bill or whatever the Cantwell bill might become over the next weeks and months. They're still assessing her bill. They have said, and the president has said, that he would sign the House bill, which would force the parent company of, well, it wouldn't necessarily force. It would require them, the parent company, to sell TikTok to a U.S. group or company, and the data that the app collects could no longer be stored on servers in China, would have to be stored on servers on U.S. soil. Steve Mnuchin, the former Treasury Secretary and a very wealthy individual, is reportedly trying to put together a group to do just that, which is buy TikTok. And, you know, it's wildly popular. I have younger relatives, and, you know, at holiday time, they're not looking at Facebook or Instagram. You know, they're off in the corner.
Right.
And they're looking at TikTok. And people do make a lot of money off social media, especially TikTok now. And the free speech is something that senators are a little more mindful of. So I think this thing is going to hang around. I just wonder if senators, and there are a lot of senators who are going to be in competitive races themselves for reelection, do they want to, frankly, just to be frank, do they want to piss off thousands, hundreds of thousands or millions of voters who use TikTok or make money off TikTok or, you know, use it for work? That's a lot of voters that are going to be upset if this thing passes in the form of the House bill. Maybe that breathes some life into the Cantwell bill. There's a long way to go here. And full disclosure, TikTok, the parent company, spends a lot on lobbying on Capitol Hill. Roll Call, for instance, other publications that are focused on Washington and Congress, you know, we have big TikTok ad buys, and there's a reason. These newspapers, our paper, sits around in congressional offices, you know, for a week or so on the coffee table when constituents come in or lobbyists come in, and the conference room or the waiting room to meet with a lawmaker. There's Roll Call, there's The Hill, there's Politico. And that TikTok ad is there for a reason. I would expect to see more of that. That very targeted advertising, and the TikTok lobbyist, who, by the way, a lot of former congressional aides now lobby for the parent company of TikTok. So this thing has a long way to go. And I have to wonder if senators are really going to upset millions of voters in an election year. So maybe next year. I mean, it could happen right after the election in a lame duck session, for instance. That would be the longest time any senator has before they face voters again. So I think it's a long shot before the election, and that was a very long filibuster. I apologize.
that was an effective filibuster. Michael, you think that speaking of appearance versus reality, is TikTok a cyber weapon? I mean, it's noted that, and Ryan Macbeth noted it as well, a lot of younger Americans are getting their news off of TikTok. So
yeah.
does that that bother you? I mean, being a so is it a cyber weapon? Is it a good thing to limit it?
Well, so as I understand it, is that TikTok's parent company is Chinese, and this is an app that's followed by 170 million users in the U.S. And if they force them to sell it, then somehow we'll be safe from Chinese spying. Really? if Chinese intelligence wants to gather data on Americans or anybody else for that matter, or vice versa, we want to gather data on Chinese, we can do this without TikTok. I mean, you would think that our national security apparatus can gather all the intelligence that it needs. There are lots of data aggregators and others out there who can get them this stuff. So I'm not really sure that this is more than appearance without substance on the issue of whether or not forcing a U.S. ownership team would somehow make us safer from Chinese oversight of U.S. And give them less of an ability to interfere in our elections. But to me, more troubling is a question that we've talked about before, which is, what are the First Amendment implications of this? That you don't like the idea of who owns a company and therefore you're going to force them to sell? So I don't like Elon Musk's politics. So do I get to force him to sell? I don't like Mark Zuckerberg's politics. Do I get to force him to sell? Is the notion that simply because it's a foreign national that owns it somehow means that the First Amendment should give way to sort of politics? I don't get it, Brian. I think there has to be a better way of dealing this. It smells to me of censorship in a way that I don't feel comfortable with. That I think that there's a slippery slope with respect to. And I just don't like the idea that the government can say to private parties that you can't do business unless you meet our litmus test of acceptability. It's just too dangerous for me. So, for example, if they said they're a foreign adversary. So if TikTok said, all right, fine, we're going to sell to the left leaning party of France or Britain or some other left-leaning organization that makes conservatives anxious, or vice versa, some right-leaning organization in Germany or elsewhere. Do they get to do the same thing? Do we get to pick who we want to be owners of this? If that's the case, let me see. If that's the case, can I have a voice in who I want to own my professional sports teams?
Right. Well, here's the thing. The appearance versus reality part of it is huge. But here's the thing that bothers me about it. TikTok, but all social media can be used this way to drum up like false support, false. How do you get, how do you push people to the edge? Well, you can put a couple of, TikTok videos up and play them incessantly and get people to, hook onto it and spread disinformation that way. That is a legitimate problem, but it's not, just with TikTok. It's not solely the problem of TikTok. So that argument aside, when you talk about foreign ownership, it used to be against the law in the United States for any foreign company to own a U.S. media company. Now, if you're going to follow those rules, and let's be honest, that's what TikTok, that's what Facebook, that's what Twitter or X, that's what Spoutable, that's what Mastodon, that's what all of the social media companies are today's new media. If you're going, and we took away that prerequisite for ownership many years ago. Thank you, Ronald Reagan. So with that being said, if you're going to keep foreign companies from owning American journalistic enterprises or, you know, media companies, fine, but enforce it across the board. That it was Ronald Reagan who got rid of that so that a friend of his from Australia could own newspapers and, by the way, the Fox Network. So there you go. Is there's a problem for me. Is the TikTok ban good or bad? I think it's bad for the First Amendment, bad for business. Steve Mnuchin might like it, and it might fall flat on his face if it goes forward because of that alone. But divesting media of monopoly interests would be great fun for all of us. So there's good and bad with it. But at the end of the day, if you're going to ban TikTok, you're right, John. It's good, and you want to do it now during during the election. No, I don't think that's going to be very wise if you want to go after young voters. And it will affect the down ballot of many Democrats and Republicans.
Well, one thing that people haven't talked a lot about, another aspect of this is, wouldn't this be a great chance for China to stand up to the United States and not divest and keep it?
Yeah.
And the Chinese would say, well, it was your leadership, American people who won't TikTok, who did this. And they could blame both parties, but it got over 350 votes in the House. That was very bipartisan vote total. It got most of the Republicans. Most of the 50 or so who voted against it were Democrats.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was that First Amendment censorship, easy for me to say, argument. So this is a bipartisan chance for China to take a shot at both political parties. And remember,
and you
Donald
wonder
Trump,
if they will.
Donald Trump once endorsed this very idea. He tried to walk it back a little bit last week. But so this is bipartisan. This could be a chance for China to really stick it to Washington.
Yeah. Michael, you were going to hop in there.
No, I was going to say one thing, which is, of course, in practical terms, if they don't do this, all it means is that the TikTok app won't be able to be updated.
Right.
That is, in its current form, if it ended today, no more TikTok, Apple and everybody take it off their platforms. Those people who have downloaded it already will still use it. There's not a way to take it away from them. It just means these periodic updates as they fix, you know, sort of glitches or do the next iteration of it won't happen. And so slowly over a period of years, maybe the TikTok app will become less functional than it is right now or can be updated. So it's, they're not making it go away. This is just, they're slowly going to prevent it from being updated. And it seems to me, again, given that there is a First Amendment-ish overlay to this, there's got to be a better solution. This seems just too convenient to be supported.
Yeah, I agree with that.
This is a very House approach to something. The Senate usually gets involved, and this, you know, the right likes to talk about the founders. This is how the founders set up the system. The House is big and rowdy and impulsive, and the Senate was supposed to be the conscience of the legislative branch to slow things down and come up with more sophisticated outcomes. And that's exactly what's happening here. That's the start of that. So I think Michael's onto something there, and it'll be up to the Senate to come up with something else, and they're trying to do that. They're in talks right now.
We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we got to talk about the 32-hour work week, and is Netanyahu going to be leaving Israel anytime soon, or at least leadership? Stick around. We'll have that when we come back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and we are reviewing the week's news events as is our wont on the weekend with our former federal prosecutor, Michael Zeldin, and current White House correspondent and editor-at-large at CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. When we left, we were talking about TikTok, but other big news of this week were members of the U.S. Government saying that Benjamin Netanyahu's got to go in Israel. I don't know if that's going to matter to anyone, but it is a strange or at least an unexpected turn of events in the U.S. after this administration has made a huge effort to back Israel in the war against Hamas. Michael, we'll start with you. Do you see anything to this other than politics, or is this going to bubble to the surface and mean anything?
Well, it does mean something for Democratic politics in states like Michigan and Minnesota, where there's large Arab American voters, and also across the country where you have left-leaning voters who are troubled by what's going on in Gaza. And so I think, you know, cynically, that what this is about is domestic politics and bringing back voters. But I agree with the proposition that Netanyahu is a detriment to peace. There are a lot of detriments to peace in the Middle East, but Netanyahu is one of them. And unmooring ourselves to him, I think, is in the best interests of peace in the Middle East. I have to say right at the outset, I don't know anything about how to obtain peace in the Middle East. But it seems to me that Netanyahu and the coalition that he has running that country are not a peace-oriented coalition, and that changing that could change the dynamic on the ground. And so both from a domestic get-the-votes-back perspective and in the long-term interests of peace in the Middle East, it seems a smart decision. But as I say, and I'll say it quite clearly, I really am quite ignorant about how to obtain peace in the Middle East. For all of my information on how to obtain peace in the Middle East, I rely on Jared Kushner.
you got to put me on notice when you're going to say things like that. Sorry.
Wow. That was well done.
That was, yeah. Your turn, John.
I have to follow that. Oh, man.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I should have given you warning. It just came out spontaneously like a burp.
That's how the magic happens here, right? You saw it right here, folks. Oh, Mr. Kushner, he might not know how to bring peace to the Middle East. He knows how to get billions of dollars out of it. We know that. yeah, the Netanyahu has to go. We saw Senator Schumer, the Democratic leader in the Senate, who's also Jewish, give a speech this week that got everyone's attention. And he said just that it was time for new elections in Israel. The White House did not publicly agree with Senator Schumer, but they distanced themselves, but they could have put more distance between themselves and Senator Schumer than they did. You know, they could have Derrick Henry stiff-armed him away. They could have come out really tough against Schumer, and they didn't do that. I thought that was very telling. They
kind of like a trial balloon, wasn't it?
Hmm?
Kind of like a trial balloon, wasn't it?
It felt that way. It felt that way. Schumer walked it back a bit, and that made it feel even more like a trial balloon. So this is headed somewhere. We're not there yet. It's picking up steam. Biden, again this week, I wrote about this at rollcall.com. Was in Wisconsin and Michigan, and in Wisconsin there were again pro-Palestinian protesters. I believe it was near his campaign headquarters in Milwaukee. There were some protesters. They were chanting "Genocide Joe has to go" and
Yeah.
that Biden is a liar. So he's going to feel pressure, and he has to win Michigan. I don't see a scenario where Joe Biden loses Michigan and gets reelected, and there's a huge Arab American population in Michigan. Over 100,000 people in the recent
And those are
Democratic
just my
presidential
cousins
primaries.
alone.
Yes, there you go. They voted uncommitted. They didn't vote for Biden. That's 100,000 people. You know, if the war drags on and Biden does not publicly break with Netanyahu, call for elections in Israel, that's a big problem. 100,000 people in Michigan could give the presidency to Donald Trump. It's that
Yeah.
simple.
Yeah.
It's that
That's
simple.
that. So I felt that what you pointed out is what I thought about the entire time. I think this was a trial balloon to float it to see how the reaction that would be gotten out of it, and at the same time signal to voters who are questioning Biden and the Democratic Party that they are willing to move in that direction. That they and look, let's be honest. In fact, we all know covering the White House, but behind the scenes, that the administration has been pounding on Netanyahu to change its tactics. They have said it in the briefing room, thinly veiled criticism, but
Yes.
they are upset with Netanyahu and have been. And for this to
Clearly.
erupt out into
Yes.
the public like this lets you know just how frustrated the administration truly is with Netanyahu. But
They are very, yes,
Brian,
Brian, to
that's
that.
the, go on,
Go
Joe.
ahead. Go ahead. Okay. I thought you heard that not clearly this week. I don't know, Brian, if you were on a Zoom call with John Kirby.
Yes.
Now, let me get this right. He is the National Security Communications Advisor.
Yeah.
That's a fancy way to say he's the National Security Press Secretary without using the P word and the S word.
Yes.
Anyway, he did a Zoom call, very creative title there. I said
Yeah.
the editor at large, right? There was he was clearly frustrated on the Zoom call with reporters on Thursday about the humanitarian aid. And it's not getting into Gaza. Margaret Brennan from CBS News, a former White House and national security correspondent for CBS News, she tweeted recently, she quote tweeted a USAID tweet that had the director of that organization, Samantha Power, in Jordan at a storage facility with humanitarian aid boxes stacked as high as the ceiling and around the facility. And Margaret tweeted, "Why do American officials never finish the thought or the sentence about who's holding all that aid up?" And
Yeah.
Margaret made the point that this is not the first of these kinds of tweets where you see all this aid not getting to people who are starving or very sick or malnourished. And we're starting to hear the administration more and more be critical of the Israelis for not allowing this stuff to get into Gaza. And we're headed for a moment where Biden's going to have to make that decision of breaking with Netanyahu. And
Yeah.
I just think it's sooner rather than later.
And I think
It
that's what
really
the
feels like
Schumer,
it's building
I
to a
mean, come
crescendo.
on, Schumer and Biden talk. So, I don't think anybody was blindsided by it. Michael, go ahead.
No. They coordinated. That
Yeah.
Schumer. Biden said yesterday that Schumer did give his staff a heads up about the
Yeah.
tweet. Yeah.
Well, I would like to see the administration act more unilaterally, such as bringing offshore U.S. military aid ships, the floating hospitals. We should have a flotilla of those ships out there. We should be building a port, help building a port in Gaza to get stuff in. I think if we are sending aid and it is just sitting there rotting on docks because of either, and I expect there's both. That there's both Palestinian interference with the distribution of stuff, as well as
Oh,
the
sure.
Israeli distribution of it, you know, that we should say, like, you know what, we know how to provide services beyond airlifting stuff. We can go there with special forces if we need to and build a damn dock and bring the stuff in ourselves. And I think it would be well received politically, and of course by the people of Gaza who need the aid. I just don't, again, I have to rely on Jared Kushner for advice, but I just don't understand why we're not being more proactive when I think we have the ability to be so.
Well, that's to me, this is the epitome of the problem with the Biden administration. Its inability to communicate effectively, its inability to move effectively. Look, John, you said that Schumer's office, you know, the president said Schumer's office had given him a heads up about, you know, the announcement. I'm gonna call bullshit on that right there.
There
I
you
believe
go.
it.
Nice.
I believe it was the administration. I think it was the other way around. I think the
Oh.
administration said, "Hey, go, Chucky, go." And because he would be a better effective communicator on that issue than Biden, who has supported Netanyahu, even though he doesn't like him. So it doesn't look like the administration is pounding Netanyahu. It's Schumer. So it's all
Right.
that to me is just politics in Washington. But acting unilaterally, I don't think that's going to happen, Michael, although I'd love to see it happen.
Well,
But anyway, we're go ahead. One last comment, John, and we'll move
I
on.
want to jump in on something that Michael said about why we're not, the U.S. is not being more proactive and doing more. I ran in. I was on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, on Thursday, and ran into a former colleague of mine, Joe Gould, who's a defense reporter at Politico now, a very good defense reporter at Politico. We were chatting about this very thing, and he was telling me that Pentagon officials and even members of the armed services committees are very nervous about, okay, we can build the pier, we can bring in the supply ships, we can protect those ships with, you know, destroyers and other things. They're very concerned about how are they going to unload the supplies from the pier? How are they going to go from the pier to the shore? Because they don't want you, the Pentagon does not want U.S. boots on the ground
Ground,
in
yeah.
Gaza. And even if it's a beach, that's boots on the ground in Gaza. The Pentagon is trying to solve this problem. They don't have a solution as of 2 days ago. So I think the Pentagon is being very careful and not trying to even give the appearance of guys in with U.S. flags on their shoulders and AR-15s on the beach in Gaza. They don't want that image blasted across the Middle East.
Well, but let
Yeah.
me ask you a question. If we unloaded this stuff on the shore, and working with the Red Cross or other reliable agencies, and you know, there's a big question about whether the UN agencies are reliable partners, but
That's part of the problem.
even if it were to be US Marines on the shore, offloading stuff and bringing it in. I'm not sure what the negative image of that is across the Middle East. If we have US military delivering aid, what's the perception, John? I'm not saying, what's the
Right.
perception that it's a bad look for us?
That's not the bad look. The bad look is when Hamas baits U.S. Marines or soldiers into shooting back.
Yes.
When they set a trap and especially Marines will fire if fired upon. That's the rules of engagement. They have to protect themselves and they have to protect their teammates. When they go on shore, they have to protect the supplies. And we know Hamas would do that. And we've seen some weird things from the IDF as well inside Gaza. So that's the fear, is what happens when the bullets start flying because American forces will protect themselves and their teammates.
Which is why right now what we've seen, and look, we're involved in a war, whether you want to admit it or not. The
Oh,
Houthis are
yeah, for
firing on
sure.
us. that we're firing back. That's war, however they want to define it. But this is containable because they're on ships, they're in the ocean, not boots on the ground. Once you put those boots on the ground, you lose the fog of war. There's that is exactly. truly going to be the fog of war. So that for that, what that's worth. We're going to finish today. I have one question to ask. It's a letter that came from AFID37. I don't even want to know. So here's this. Again, here's the question. Will you leave? I'll let everybody answer. Will you leave the U.S. when Trump wins in a landslide? And why can't you admit he's serving his country better than anyone since Washington? John?
No, I will not leave the country. I will stand my post at the White House and do my job and cover him with the same critical eye that I've covered several presidents, including him when he was president and the current president, Joe Biden, and we'll have another election 4 years after that.
How about you, Michael?
I have no place to go and nobody that will take me. So
same here.
But I do not accept the proposition that Trump is the second coming and the greatest gift that American democracy
has
had.
Come on now, Michael. Brian and I were on the South Lawn driveway the day that it's a bright, sunny day that Trump looked to the heavens and informed us that he's the chosen one.
Yes, he was looking straight into the the solar eclipse too. So right. I don't know if we're going to go that far. But I'm not going anywhere. He might try to shove my butt in jail, but I ain't going anywhere. Screw him. He's got to go, not me. At the end of the day, I don't accept him as a second coming either, and believe that he's not going to win in a landslide. And I can't tell you that he's the best president since Washington. I think he's the worst president in history, but that's just me. So with that said, I'll let you guys plug whatever you want. John, you're up first, brother.
Follow along. Another exciting week. I think we have a government funding deadline. Our budget
Woo-hoo!
Team. Our budget team will be all over that. We've got Biden traveling for some fundraising and other activities this week, and you can follow the action at rollcall.com.
And Michael.
I am still hosting That Said with Michael Zeldin. It's a book-based podcast for Women's History Month. We have done so far Katie Couric on her book, Going There, and a book, an interesting book about an author named, by a person named Janet, by, let me say again, another, and an interesting book about a woman named Marguerite Harrison, who was America's first female spy during the World War I period, written by Janet Wallach. And then this coming week, we're going to be having an interesting conversation with a woman named Martha McPhee. About
so interesting,
her,
you can't remember her name?
No, Martha's book, Omega Farm, about her upbringing, and interesting discussion about saving forests, and curiously about surviving sexual abuse, two components of her memoir. All wow. three books, Women's History Month themed.
There you go. Name of this broadcast is called Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. I want to thank everybody for joining us. We would get into the 32-hour work week, but we've already worked more than 32 hours. Maybe we'll do that next time. So thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time.